Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this event. I'm Michael Foley-Love. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's In Conversation with the Managing Editor of the New York Times, Joe Kahn. Ladies and gentlemen, at the Institute, we believe the world matters to Australia. And if the world matters, then we need to be informed about the world. And news reporting is the essential basis for that. The media market in Australia is changing. Australian coverage of the world is shrinking. Australian news bureaus abroad are closing and foreign correspondents are being recalled. Media companies are finding that The Bachelorette generates more clicks than Brexit. And by the way, congratulations to Sophie and Stu on last night's result. So that's why in 2013, we established the Lowy Institute Media Award to recognise Australian journalists who have deepened our knowledge of international policy issues in our country. And at this year's Media Award dinner, the annual lecture was delivered by one of Joe's colleagues from the op-ed page of the New York Times, Brett Stevens, who's one of the world's most influential columnists on foreign policy and politics. And Brett delivered a very fine speech at the Institute that was, I'm pleased to say, was among the most emailed articles on the New York Times website. So we enjoyed that collaboration. We're also seeing new entrants into the Australian media market. There are new digital media organisations cropping up, but also established global players such as The Times, the BBC, and The Guardian are expanding their footprint in Australia. At the Institute, we love The Times, and Joe, we welcome the fact that you are taking a closer look at Australia. So for all those reasons, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Joe Kahn to the Lowy Institute. Joe is from Boston, and he was educated at Harvard, where he was president of the student daily newspaper, the Harvard Crimson. His predecessors in that role included small figures like Franklin Roosevelt and I think John F. Kennedy. So I'm watching out for the Kahn 2020 ticket myself. Joe is a China hand. He first reported from China in 1989 after the Tiananmen. And he had 1989. And he has had over two decades of experience reporting from China for various titles such as the Dallas Morning News, the Journal, and the Times. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes, one in 1994 as part of a team of reporters looking at stories on violence against women, and one in 2006 with a colleague for stories on the Chinese justice system. He's also held various editorial positions at the Times and was appointed managing editor in September last year. So he's now second in command of the Times newsroom, and he's charged with helping lead one of the world's indispensable news sources at a remarkable time. And of course, his visit is very timely with the recent 19th Party Congress in Beijing, the provocative behaviour in Pyongyang, the disarray in Washington, and so on. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Joe. Now, Joe, I want to ask you about Mr. Trump. But not yet. but not yet, because my experience is that if you start off with Mr. Trump, you often don't get over him. So don't fear. I will return to Mr. Trump and ask Joe about that. The way I'm going to conduct this is I'll ask Joe questions for about 20 minutes or half an hour, and then I'm going to go to the audience and give you all an opportunity to ask him a question. Joe, let's start with Xi Jinping. Mm. Obviously, we've just got through the 19th Party Congress at which Joe was elevated, elevated further, enshrined in the Constitution. He's very definitely at the core of the party now. How significant a figure do you think that Xi Jinping will prove to be in Chinese history? And do you think he will only stick around for the 10 years that we've become accustomed to, or do you think he might seek to stay longer?
Well, there's definitely a strong chance that he's going to seek to stay a lot longer than anybody would have predicted going into his first term in office. I was not in Beijing for this party congress, but I covered three other party congresses, which are these, you know, every 5 year events. And in the period that I was involved with covering China, it was sort of the latter years of Deng Xiaoping and then the Jiang Zemin years and the Hu Jintao years. And, you know, we developed this sense of a Communist Party, which is obviously a one-party ruling party authoritarian regime, but it was one that for years and years developed this essentially a self-discipline mechanism for being able to have an orderly succession within a one-party state, which was kind of a remarkable achievement because it's, you know, the conventional wisdom in the 80s and the 90s was that if China was going to basically survive as a market economy and become a more dynamic global player, it was going to have to move to a more democratic system. It couldn't sustain one-party rule indefinitely. And then the betting started to shift a little bit. They could probably sustain one party, but they'd have to become a more open dynamic within the party itself. The big surprise with Xi Jinping is that he has managed essentially not to move them forward in any kind of a Western or more open model, even within a one-party state, but to take them back, you know, to take them back to essentially a complete consolidation of power in a single individual, which I had thought, and I think generations of Chinese scholars had come to think, was considered a threat to the dominance of the party if they allowed an individual along the lines of Mao Zedong to control all the levers of power, from the military to the party to the state, in the government, all in one individual's hands. And yet, Xi Jinping at this party congress managed to carry it off. I think it's been forecast, including by us, that this was in the cards, but the fact that he was able to so completely eliminate the party tradition of the last couple of decades and consolidate power and enshrine his own thinking, such as it is, into the Chinese constitution is a remarkable, remarkable achievement.
What about in the immediate future, in the next 5 years? There seem to be two schools of analysts. There are those who think that in his first term, Xi went left in order to turn right. That is, he sought to consolidate the role of the party in the first term so that he could liberalize things in the second term. And there are others who think, well, what you see is what you get. And we now have a sense of what Xi Jinping's vision is for China, and we're likely to get more of that in the second term. Where would you come down on that argument?
I would lean toward the what you see is what you get. I don't pick up that there is a secret liberalizing agenda in Xi Jinping. You can't rule it out, but it's very, very typical of the kind of progressive thinking in China to put your trust in, you know, the hidden progressive instincts of the leaders at the top of the one-party state and say that they can't tolerate any kind of instability for the moment. But as soon as they get just past this next hurdle, they're going to have enough control and their better angels will be released and, you know, a flood of innovation and openness will follow. You can't prove a negative. I can't prove that won't happen, but there's been no inkling of that really from Xi Jinping. In fact, quite the contrary. I mean, the controls over the media are far more extensive and effective today than they were when I was in China. The sophistication of censorship and the Chinese, you know, the great firewall of China is more complete and comprehensive today than it was in the 2000s and the first decade of this century. The kind of sophistication of control over the biggest state enterprises and even the biggest private enterprises that have state-like characteristics to them, and the way that they're run and their staffing and their communication with the government, suggest to me that, you know, China still retains very much a statist agenda. That Xi Jinping is extremely unlikely to do anything that he perceives as weakening party control. And, you know, the crackdown that we've seen over the last 18 months or so on some of the biggest privately held Chinese conglomerates and tycoons, I think, is an indication of a clear indication that Xi Jinping wants to avoid, you know, a Russian-style kind of oligarch class, which, you know, could have anything like a counterweight to the central government. So I really don't see, I could be surprised, but I just don't see any indication that we're going to see a new wave of sort of reform or innovation, at least in the way the West thinks about it.
Talk to us a bit about how the challenges the Times faces in covering China. We know the Chinese are very sensitive, for example, to reporting on the financial affairs of top leaders. I understand you don't really have a digital footprint as such in China. You can't get through the great Chinese firewall. But what's it like for your reporters in China?
We are extremely committed to writing about China, and we would love to be able to write about China for Chinese as well as for people outside of China. We have extensive bureaus in both Beijing and Shanghai, and we actually do operate a Chinese language website, which is staffed by people in Beijing. But over the last few years, the tightening of restrictions on has really limited our ability to have access to a Chinese audience, even those people who are fairly sophisticated in their use of VPNs and other workarounds to Chinese internet censorship. So journalistically, China is an enormous story. I mean, there's just no way that, you know, you can be a global publication wanting to cover the most important news in the world and understand the leading trends and not invest very heavily in China coverage. And in fact, you know, we've had the luck of having a couple of Australians who are, you know, Chris Buckley and Jane Perlez, who are you know, pretty integral to our Beijing operation. And Chris, I think, is now probably more Chinese than Australian, but he was born and raised here, and his knowledge of Chinese politics and his you know, instincts for the story there, I think, give us an advantage as a publication that, you know, I don't think any of our peers really has. So we're really lucky to have a staff there, and we are grateful, I don't know if that's the right word, to the Chinese authorities for allowing us not only to maintain but to continue to increase our journalistic presence, even as we've run into some fairly strong resistance to the sort of American style coverage, particularly, as you said, of sort of what we call kind of money and politics kind of coverage, which is just a category of reporting that the Chinese fundamentally do not think is legitimate. You know, when you connect power and authority with sort of family wealth and kind of accumulation of assets, that's a natural target for Western journalists. It's pretty irresistible in China. But it really, you know, keeps us on a kind of a razor's edge in terms of our relationship with the Chinese authorities, because they genuinely just consider that to be just an illegitimate subject for journalism. And we can't really imagine having a big presence there and aggressively covering the Chinese story without looking at those kind of issues. So we're thankful that we're able to keep our presence and even increase our presence there, but it's not the kind of thing where we sort of say everything's great, we have a great relationship. And also, we would love to be able at some point to reach that giant consumer market of people who are starved for good news and information inside China. So in terms of the last question, I hope we're wrong about Xi Jinping, and he's got a brilliant reform of kind of throwing open the Chinese doors and letting us all come in there and compete fairly. But for the moment, there isn't much sign of it.
One of the big stories about Chinese influence abroad has been Chinese influence operations abroad, and that's something Australia that has been at the forefront of the Australian debate in the last year. Attempts by individuals and organisations that are deeply connected to the party state to influence the Australian debate and influence Australian policy in ways that would be congenial to Beijing, whether it's by donating to politicians or political parties or think tanks or universities or controlling the activities of Chinese students or buying Chinese language media, for example. How big is, are you seeing this story throughout Asia, throughout the world? How big of an issue is this? And how do you think countries like Australia should respond to that?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's a huge push by China, which initially seemed to me to be a little bit ham-handed, like many things, you know, the Chinese state does is they initially starting, I think really they started around the time when they were hosting the Olympics in 2008. They decided China just needed a better image in the world and the Olympics was going to be the moment for China to advertise essentially, you know, its soft power. And they handed out what seemed at the time probably still is a sort of phenomenal amount, a sum of money to leading, you know, state media companies and said, go out and do in the rest of the world what you've long been tasked with doing in China, which is sort of promote the image of the government. So suddenly, you know, Western media, I'm sure Australian media was the same thing. You had these People's Daily and China Daily and Xinhua News Agency and all these others coming. And, you know, we want to buy, you know, 4 pages of advertisement and we will, you know, all we want to do is for you to run some of our news stories in English and we'll pay, you know, it's a New York Times, it's $120,000 a page and they would buy a 4-page spread and just run, you know, essentially what are Chinese propaganda stories in that space. And it was like, this is your influence campaign. It doesn't seem essentially very cost effective, but we're not really going to oppose it as long as you want to. Then I think it started to get a little more nuanced and effective, including, you know, the way that they communicate through their diplomatic missions and through student communities and the way that they used, you know, the enormous outflow of Chinese students to influence universities around the world, their Confucius Institutes, and the funding for universities that came from that. You know, a general sense that if you were not, as either a business person or an academic, consistently saying things that were friendly to China, you were starting to find your access inside China drying up. And I think they, you know, without sort of explicitly declaring that to be the policy, effectively it did become policy. And I do think that that's a fairly effective way when you're the second largest major economy in the world and by far the fastest growing to begin to allow Chinese influence to spread to many in the West who are eager for that access to have. How do you respond to it? I think you just have to be really, as Western institutions or as a Western country like Australia, I think it makes a lot of sense to essentially have a constructive relationship with China, but to always stand on principle. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, the small compromises that you make, you know, will get in the door with them. If we just withhold publication of this article, or if we don't allow this person to come and speak, that, you know, we'll keep a good relationship and we'll be able to do things over time. China's really experienced at playing that game, and I think they win over time if they get lots of little compromises from lots of different, you know, whether it's businesses, whether it's academic institutions or others over time. And I think you've seen that with, you know, with, for instance, Silicon Valley and the way that, you know, in a very mercenary way, I think you've seen most of the big Silicon Valley companies just basically ask which way they should bend over and toward to get greater access to the Chinese market. And China just takes full advantage of that. I mean, you know, I think Facebook basically helped them to improve their censorship algorithm in certain ways as a kind of goodwill gesture to getting into the market, but they're not in the market, you know. And Google did the right thing, you know, probably 8-9 years ago and stood on principle when they were asked to start censoring search results. But even Google is trying to find ways to get back in. I think Apple has made a lot of compromises to be as present in the China market as it is. And China's exercised a lot more control over the distribution of apps in the Apple App Store. You know, no amount of sort of goodwill, no amount of compromise is going to get you free and open status in the Chinese market. They're just going to ask for more. So I think the response has to be to stand on principle, to do business with the Chinese when they're willing to do business, but not to just find all kinds of ways to make them to compromise in order to get in.
Well, speaking of making compromises, let me ask you about President Trump's approach to China. During the election campaign, he was very, very tough on China. He said China is an economic enemy. He promised to declare China a currency manipulator on day one. In office, it's been a very different scene. He created some leverage initially by querying the One China policy, but then he appeared to give that leverage away in exchange for an introductory phone call. Steve Bannon's heart presumably broke on that day when Donald Trump's grandchildren welcomed Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago by singing songs and reading poetry in Mandarin. Obviously, this is driven to a large extent by the fact that Mr. Trump wants help on North Korea, and he thinks perhaps he can do that. How do you rate this approach? Is this another example of these sorts of compromises that in the end are not going to get you where you want? Is it the case that the Chinese Communist Party knows how to deal with nouveau-riche billionaires like Mr. Trump? Or is this smart statecraft given the importance of the bilateral relationship and the fact that North Korea is probably Mr. Trump's biggest security problem?
Probably I'm not going to be quoted as saying it was smart statecraft on the part of Donald Trump, but no, I mean, I think with all things with Trump, he plays multiple sides of the question at the same time, and you know, he goes with his own gut instincts and emotional response. I mean, and you know, I think he seized on a sort of a, you know, during the campaign certainly, and probably into his presidency, has continued to seize on a fault line over trade. And the perception that Americans have lost in the game of global trade, and there's no bigger player and no country with a larger trade surplus with the United States than China. So in some ways, as he sort of continues to push on that somewhat populist, nativist political line, China inevitably is going to stay in his sights as a target, and I don't expect him to give that up. You know, I think you'll hear about it from time to time. And on the other hand, you know, I think even Trump realizes that at any given moment, you can't literally be enemies with everybody at the same time. I mean, you know, he's sort of picked, you know, North Korea as the leading threat. And how much sense does it make? I mean, there were some confusing moments, don't get me wrong, where he was simultaneously targeting North Korea and South Korea, you know, in rhetorical blasts. And that doesn't strike me as brilliant statecraft. And you know, counting on China to step up to the table and take steps on economic sanctions it hasn't been willing to take, and simultaneously publicly attacking China. I mean, typically, just diplomatically, it doesn't work to do that at the same moment. However, there is this kind of, you know, craziness inherent in his diplomacy that could end up, you know, probably not through really careful calculation, but just because they're not quite sure what he'll do next, having some impact on the Chinese and making them at least a little bit more willing to take a hard look at some of their stances on this, simply because it would be so disastrous for the Chinese as well as for pretty much everybody else in the region and the world if there was an open conflict with North Korea. And I don't think that they know for sure what the United States is going to do. I think they felt they knew what the United States was ultimately going to be willing to do under George W. Bush and under Obama. I think just as we can't quite be sure what Donald Trump is going to do with the North Korea problem, I don't think the Chinese can be sure what he's going to do. And that uncertainty, whether it's intentional or not, may have some impact on making the Chinese kind of take a hard look at their stance on this. I don't think that means that they're going to move fundamentally at the end of the day, but it would really surprise me if they weren't, you know, scratching their heads and trying to figure out what, you know, this kind of volatile leader of the United States is, what his bottom line really is. So it's an interesting moment, which I think, you know, in basically it feels like diplomacy in Asia is fairly tectonic over time. I mean, you can watch something like the conflict between China and Japan. You know, it sort of, it has hot moments and then it cools off. And if you're a correspondent covering these things and you get the buildups of some major moment in tension between in China and Japan, we all learned, don't get too excited about it. You should write about it. It's a story. You never know for sure. But is there really likely to be the outbreak of war? These are two very pragmatic and calculating countries that have a certain degree of ability to turn up the volume and turn it down again. And they've always turned it up when they think it's in their interest and turned it back down when it's not. It's not clear to anybody, at least yet, that Donald Trump has that same fine tune on the volume control, you know? And I think that that's a real element of volatility. It throws some uncertainty into all kinds of planning across the region, including in Beijing. So it could have some interesting results.
I think like Spinal Tap, Mr. Trump prefers the volume turned up to 11. Let me come to Mr. Trump. Let me ask you, how have American institutions responded to the election of Mr. Trump? How would you rate the performance of the Congress, for example? We've seen just in the last couple of days, you've finally seen some Republican senators come out very clearly against Mr. Trump, although I note they're doing that as they leave on their way out the exit door. What about how the press has responded? What about the judiciary? I mean, Mr. Trump does seem to be this sort of almost like a foreign entity in the US system. How have the institutions which have built up over many years, how have they performed so far in this stress test?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that there's been a degree of resilience. You know, certainly in the media, I think there's been not formally part of the government system of the U.S., but an important pillar of independent check and balance on power. I think the media has continued to hold up reasonably well. The New York Times, but not only the New York Times, is pretty committed to independent and aggressive coverage of this administration, but also, you know, open enough to sort of covering in a fair way some of the shifts that are occurring in American politics and exploring the other side of the questions. Congress, I think the jury is, the jury is out. I think that as you pointed out, there are certainly some signs within the establishment side of the Republican Party that there's enough frustration with Trump that some people are willing to defy him and take the risk. But I think on the whole, you know, he is fighting an insurgent campaign, which requires that he basically take full control of his party. And I think he's probably succeeding in that, not with the full enthusiastic participation of everybody who's been an incumbent in that party to date. But I think they're definitely going to go into the 2018 election. And it's very unlikely that any Republican is going to get elected in 2018 with any kind of a platform of open opposition or even passive opposition to Trump. You know, I think he'll at least have his shot at getting full control of the party after that election. That said, you know, as we saw with the healthcare debate and the fate of the Affordable Care Act, ultimately, every member of Congress has a direct relationship with their own voters. And Donald Trump's poll numbers are consistent but weak. You know, his base doesn't seem to be budging, but he doesn't seem to be growing his support. And when you have a president like that who is constantly hostile and can't grow his support beyond a certain base, whether it's 38% or 42%, depending on, you know, which polls you believe. There's still a willingness among certainly some in the Senate and maybe even some in the House, which is, you know, a little bit more populist by nature, to be willing to kind of go with your constituent interest and ignore the president of the United States. And I think you'll see, you know, some signs that he's going to get more control over his party fundamentally, but also some signs of resilience in Congress. The court system, you know, we've still seen a lot of resilience. You know, judges are independent in the United States. There's very little hesitation. You know, I mean, for the left, this judge in Hawaii who continually blocks Trump's Muslim ban is you know, a hero, and he's done it repeatedly now. Ultimately, that may be overturned by the Supreme Court, and ultimately, with majority control in the Senate and with a campaign to kind of appoint as many judges as possible, Trump is going to have a big impact on the judiciary with new appointments. It may actually be one area of massive achievement for him, which he can't get through legislatively. But for the moment, the judiciary consists of a variety of judicial appointments from presidents of both parties, and is resilient and independent, and will not be cowed by the executive branch. So I do think the basic institutions of American democracy are in reasonably good shape. You know, but we're not yet 1 year into one of the most kind of challenging presidencies ever. So, you know, we should probably check in again in a couple of years and see if that
holds
true.
Well, you're always welcome back to do that. What about the Democratic Party? Because, I mean, I'm sure people ask you all the time, will President Trump be reelected? And the answer to that is probably he has a greater chance of being elected president the next presidential election than any other human being. The question is who would the Democratic Party put up? And underlying that question is, are the Democrats going to get their act together, and can they coalesce around a serious candidate who can win, potentially win a majority in the Electoral College? What's your sense of how the Democrats are reacting to this unprecedented challenge represented by Mr. Trump?
Yeah, I don't think the Democrats yet have a consensus on how they're going to challenge Trump. I think there's an enormous hunger to take a bite at the apple among many different Democrats, and I think the Democratic primary campaign for president leading up to the 2020 presidential race is going to be, if anything, more crowded than the Republican primary campaign leading up to the 2016 race. I mean, it will be a totally open field with certainly no sense of incumbency, but also, people from widely different Democrats from widely different experiences across the country basically salivating at the opportunity to take on Trump. But I think you're going to see, you know, the biggest fault line is going to be between those who see a fairly wide vacancy in the center of American politics, between the essentially mainstream Republicans who have been forced to the right or forced out of office by Trump, to what had been the center left of the Democratic Party, which historically speaking is a wide enough gap, you know, to drive a truck through. I mean, that's a huge opportunity in politics, but it's a centrist opportunity. So if you're a Democrat centrist running against Trump, that's what Hillary Clinton was doing, and it's kind of the spectrum that Barack Obama was in, and it's certainly the territory occupied by Bill Clinton when he was running. And frankly, it's where George W. Bush was. Almost every major recent president would fit in that spectrum, and the temptation to run in that part for that part of the vote will be enormous. But Trump will then oppose another centrist candidate with his right-wing insurgency, and a lot of Democrats, after the experience in 2016, are going to say, we can't do that. We have to go way to the left. We have to have a left-wing insurgency as powerful or more powerful than the right-wing insurgency that Trump is leading. We have to get our voters back from him, because there are a lot of democratically leaning voters who went for Trump. And the only way we're going to appeal is with a shift much further to the left, a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren style shift, which is going to tap into the anger and the resentment, you know, calls to impeachment or whatever it is, which are going to radicalize the left just as the right has been radicalized. And I think that debate it's very hard to predict how that's going to come out, but it's going to be a really interesting primary season for the Democrats as they try to sort that out.
Let me ask you one more question about Mr. Trump and the media, and then let me go to the audience and give them an opportunity to ask you a question. The question is about the Russia story. Where do you think that's going to go? How much legs does that have? Because when you look at the potential mortal threats to Donald Trump, that's the one that looms the largest. Now, Mueller seems to be the only guy in Washington who doesn't leak at the moment. It's hard to know exactly what he has. Do you think he's going to find something revelatory? Are there revelatory things to find? Will he find them? And will they be such a big deal that a Republican-dominated Congress is going to have to act on them? And feel free to let us in on any scoops from Times reporting if you wish.
I mean, we have, you know, the focus on Russia for us obviously has been so overwhelming, you know, in the last 8-9 months in trying to answer exactly that question journalistically as best we can, and obviously there's been multiple different congressional inquiries into it, and then the biggest and most powerful inquiry, as you said, is Mueller's, because he has the power of subpoena and he can pursue criminal prosecutions and basically force people to turn state's witness, and you know, I think we think it's extremely likely that there will be some indictments. Very likely of Trump's one-time campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who had his own very extensive dealings with the Russians, and then possibly also of Michael Flynn, who is the national security advisor for Trump and was involved in some of the early days with the communications with the Russian ambassador in Washington. So I think there's a lot of questions still to come about whether, you know, the data points at the moment, not in any sense prejudging Mueller, do not clearly add up to a very well-crafted conspiracy, you know, to cooperate, you know, with Trump and Putin, you know, sort of somehow collaborating very closely or sharing data or information on the election and inviting Russia in to manipulate. I think it's quite possible that you could have seen sort of parallel operations that happened to overlap. But I think the chances of some secretive master plan, you know, between the Trump campaign and Russia, I'm still skeptical of it. I think journalistically we're going to chase it. And if it's there and Mueller produces it, you know, that'll obviously be an enormous deal. But so far, most of the reporting that we've done and others have done have not, you know, led us clearly to indications that there was that level of collaboration. That said, there, what a prosecutor looks at is not necessarily that there was some secret conspiracy, but that people involved may have sought to impede an investigation, obstruct justice, get some personal benefit from their role as a middleman between the Trump campaign and Russia. All those things could be open to suspicion. Some of them could be judged to be illegal activity. You could easily see indictments. You could easily see this extending for many more months or years and kind of weakening the Trump presidency and enraging the president as they go on. So I at the moment, I don't think people are necessarily expecting someone to come out with some giant revelation of a secret master plan. But I also don't think that we're going to see the Russian investigation disappear overnight.
All right. Who would like to ask a question of Joe? Start with this gentleman. And if you could just wait for the microphone and in the red T-shirt, if you could indicate your name and ask a short question. Thank you.
Yeah, John Dobies. Do you think China is run by super mandarins with coherent master plans, or the government is a bit more mortal like exists in the United States and Australia?
I'm much more susceptible to believe that China has a master plan. You know, I think there's at a minimum, much more competent long-term planning. at the top of the Chinese Communist Party than there is at the top of the, you know, American government. You know, you'll have to tell me more about whether the Australians are better at that, but you've had enough governments in the last 5 years that I'd be skeptical here too. But the
now the Australian government is run by far-seeing super mensches.
Yeah,
they've got a plan for everything in Canberra.
That's right.
Thank you, Michael Ahrens. Back to the point you raised about the independence of the judiciary. You're referring to the US one. In the speech in Beijing, Xi Jinping referred to some opening up of the way in which particularly party members are being punished for corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And that allies with earlier statements by top Supreme Court people that they're going to be allowed, they're being allowed more freedom of action to deliver what we in the West call judicial action.
Yeah.
Do you see that as being an important thing in China at the moment? Do you, that the party members must be scared anyway of the way in which things are conducted against them when they're being accused of wrongdoing?
Yes. I mean, I think that the dialogue about legal change or legal reform in China is a dialogue essentially within the one-party state kind of system. There's no consideration that I'm aware of creating, you know, sort of a genuine independent legal authority that is independent of the one-party system. But there is a lot of effort to create a better process and a higher degree of autonomy for judges within the system throughout the system. In other words, you know, the way historically it worked is if you're the party official of a township or a county, or certainly the provincial level party officials, you have a tremendous amount of oversight, if not unchecked authority, to control the judiciary in that sector of the Chinese government's purview. And similarly, at each level up the system, just as you would appoint a party official or a government director or a state enterprise director for a company that's controlled at that level, so you would appoint, you know, judges. And therefore, when corruption entered into the system and had to be heard primarily at a local level because the jurisdiction is local, the judge who you appointed is sitting in judgment of the officials who are being charged in your jurisdiction. So you weren't getting a real check and balance on the system. And it was very much in the interest of the top levels of the Communist Party, and this actually predates Xi Jinping, you know, to try to fix that. So you're getting a degree of judicial check and balance on local level corruption, which the local level officials cannot manipulate at their own beck and call, because otherwise you really have no way to control corruption. And so you get a lot of the rhetoric, which sounds somewhat Western, entering into the dialogue about Chinese legal reform and judicial independence and you know, appointment of judges. But there's no opportunity for someone at Xi Jinping's level to be judged in any sense by an independent judiciary the way, say, the Supreme Court would be able to be a check and balance on the American president. They're not considering an extra party kind of system. But I do think there's a lot of change within the party to give Xi Jinping a better control over his own officials.
Just wondering, back to Trump, what do you think it would take for his base to drop away from him? Or sort of feel that maybe they didn't get what they thought they were buying, or they sort of just entirely rusted on whatever he does?
Mm. It's a good question because, you know, typically the way you assess a president's success or failure is, you know, how thoroughly his political agenda is really implemented and the legislation that he gets through. And that so far has not been, you know, a meaningful measure of Trump's popularity. His popularity is sort of roughly similar to what it was when he came into office, even though giant parts of his legislative agenda remain unenacted at this point. And there's something possibly inherent in an insurgency-style populist political campaign, which is not entirely dependent on results. You know, it's dependent, you know, kind of on this attitude of opposition and the fact that he has been willing, continually willing, to take on any force of, you know, establishment power in the United States, to take on the court system, to take on the Congress, to take on his own party, to take on the media. And as he takes on simultaneously all these forces that are holding him back, he has a pretty good narrative that, you know, he may not have gotten his agenda through, but that's because everybody is stupid or everybody is corrupt or, you know, he still needs to work on draining the swamp. And, you know, the narrative doesn't exhaust itself very clearly early on. And I think what is the tipping point for his base in terms of when they kind of wake up a little bit to this is really an open question. I honestly don't feel like, you know, our kind of past history is a very good guide to that. I actually think, you know, it'll be really interesting to watch what happens if he actually succeeds in getting tax reform through the Congress, which is probably the part of the legislative agenda which is most sacred to Republicans and which Trump has been so strongly in support of. If he passes what is primarily a giant corporate tax cut as part of a tax reform plan, how's that going to play with his base? And how much of his base is really, really interested in a corporate, you know, tax cut? I think if he actually achieves it and people see actual results and can independently assess those results, you may counterintuitively see a little bit of a shift away from Trump. He's actually stronger in a strong position when he's just doing battle with everybody as opposed to actually running on his record. But it's not exactly a prediction. I don't like predictions. It's just more something to watch.
One of the elements of the establishment that he has fired at, of course, is the New York Times. And I wonder, can you characterize for me Trump's attitude to and relationship with the Times? Because on the one hand, I think he said that you're failing a number of times on Twitter and he's highly critical of some of your stories. But on the other hand, he's a lifetime New Yorker. He came to visit your newspaper, I think, in the transition period, if I remember. And you guys have a couple of journalists in particular that he obviously talks to a lot and who have incredible connections in Trump world. How would you characterize the relationship, and what does he think of the Times?
Yeah, it's a little schizophrenic, I would say. We know that he reads us pretty thoroughly. He reads us in print. He doesn't seem to be much of a digital consumer because he reacts to stories that we publish only after the print edition arrives in the morning at the White House. So, you know, you can basically publish it as we often do. We roll out a big, you know, piece of enterprise or, you know, some kind of analytical take on something in Trump world. And we'll often do that whenever the story is ready or we think the audience is at a peak, which typically is in, you know, sometime in the morning in U.S. time. And then, you know, it appears in print when it appears in print. We're not sort of print first with anything. So often you'll publish a story, say at 10 a.m., you know, and you'll get a big reaction to it, nothing from Trump. And Trump's reaction only comes at 5 a.m. the next morning because that's when he sees the story actually in print. And then he starts firing off, you know, failing New York Times on his Twitter feed. And it's kind of like, wow, that's a delayed reaction. But you realize he just only reads and he does Twitter on his phone, but I don't think he reads on his phone. What do you kind of make of the fact that he is simultaneously attacking us and also talking to us? I mean, I just put it, you know, I think Trump just genuinely deeply has a love-hate relationship. I mean, he loves seeing his name in print. He likes being taken seriously by the New York Times. He likes, you know, there are occasionally articles that he likes and he thinks are fair. Mostly he thinks we have coverage of him that is unfair. But his attacks on us do not apparently add up in his own mind to, you know, it's it's a little bit just like, you know, we're an establishment institution that's going to be there whether Trump remains president for 8 years or not. And we're just a reliable kind of punching bag for him and a symbol of sort of the New York elite, basically, that always sat in judgment of this Queens boy who never quite measured up to being, you know, fully accepted by you know, the community in Manhattan. And to him, the Times is a little bit of a symbol of that. So he still wants to be accepted and he wants to be approved of. But at the same time, he wants to have unlimited right to just sort of attack us. And it's a little bit disproportionate because he's now actually president of the United States, and some of his damaging rhetoric could really have an effect. But on the other hand, you know, when he tweets failing New York Times, we tend to pretty reliably get a boost in our digital subscriptions. So we're not sort of strongly opposed to him continuing to do that kind of battle with us.
We're almost out of time. This gentleman's been very patient with his hand. I haven't seen any women's hands up. I'd like to call on one if there's someone who'd like to ask a question.
There's one back there.
Great. So we're going to take these two questions at the same time, if that's all right with you,
sure.
Joe, and go over to you. Yes.
Brian Everingham, digital subscriber. And a question about the Supreme Court and the legislature. Would you hazard a guess as to where it's going to fall regarding the gerrymander case?
Thank you. If we ignore all the bombast and the hyperbole around Trump and look what is actually happening in the administration, some people would argue that he's in a distraction that is allowing very corrosive things to happen in terms of the efficiency of the administration. He's certainly changed the way in which the Environment Department operates. He's starving State Department of resources.
Yeah.
Is this an issue that we should be very concerned about, that we're focusing on the Twitter feed and all the hyperbole when there are serious erosions of the efficiency of the US administration happening behind the scene?
Both good questions. In terms of the gerrymandering, I can't really predict at this point which way the Supreme Court will come out, but, you know, probably like so many cases in recent years, this comes back to the aging Justice Kennedy and which way he decides to go on a critical issue, because he's on the gerrymandering question and many others, the swing vote. And just based on, you know, the tea leaf reading when they had live testimony on this, he was, you know, the questions that he was asking suggested a degree of you know, skepticism about these states that have so thoroughly gerrymandered the electoral system, and some willingness to, you know, be open to some sort of judicial restraint on that. So, I mean, I think, you know, you never know for sure based on question time whether that's ultimately where he's leading or whether he's just trying to exhaust the argument on the other side so that he can swing back. And he does do a lot of swinging back and forth, but I think it will come down to Justice Kennedy. In terms of the core effects of so many of the things that some people in the Trump world have done, you know, I think you pointed to two of the biggest, and you know, the thorough dismantling of you know, environmental regulations under Scott Pruitt and the EPA has probably been you know, and we've spent a lot of time looking into that and documenting it. Probably, you know, if you're a conservative Republican, his area of greatest achievement. If you're a liberal Democrat, you know, one of the greatest areas of concern. You know, that said, I think it'll be very interesting to see whether some sort of sudden shift in terms of regulatory guidance from an agency like the EPA in the U.S. Ultimately has really long-term effects, or whether, you know, businesses, state-level regulation, and others will sort of shift to make up some of the gap in federal government regulation, particularly on issues like climate change, which require very long-term investments by companies that tend to be attuned to the longer-term trends at stake. You know, there isn't a lot of climate denial in the core of the U.S. business community. You know, there is, you know, in the oil and gas sector, and in obviously the coal sector, but not across the broad swath of U.S. industry. And most states also are looking at sort of long-term investments and power plant infrastructure and other kinds of regulations, which they now may be able to depart from because they're not getting pressure from the EPA, but ultimately whether they want to shift to a more kind of fossil fuel intensive environment just because the EPA opened the door to that is a real question mark. And I think there may be some who sort of see past the remaining 3 years or even a full 8-year term of Donald Trump and say it's still in our long-term interest to grapple with some of the environmental challenges that we have. Short term, I think you're going to see some impact in some states, the small number of states that are really, really heavily dependent on coal, for example. But longer term, it wouldn't be that difficult for a new president coming in to restore a lot of those regulations to the place that they had earlier, and also to reinitiate the American involvement with the Paris Climate Change Accord. The State Department is something similar. I mean, it's a little mind-boggling to even to many conservative Republicans why Trump and the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have so disempowered the U.S. diplomatic community. I mean, diplomats, respond to the commander-in-chief just as the military does. There's no particularly inherent reason why a conservative Republican would so distrust his diplomats. There is a kind of a deeply held, I think, view among some conservatives that the State Department is overfunded, and that certain State Department programs like USAID and whatever are just so deeply entrenched with inefficiency that the only way to, kind of do battle with them is simply to just completely withdraw their funding and rather than try to reform them. And that does seem to be some of what's going on in terms of really the draconian budget cuts that they've had. But I do think that, even a more mainstream Republican president who comes into office would want to reinvest in American soft power and diplomacy. There's no inherent reason why a president on the left or the right would do as much as Trump has done to defund and disempower the State Department. So that one just remains a bit of a mystery.
I'm going to squeeze in one final question, Joe. One of the challenges I think that's probably common to the Lowy Institute and the New York Times and many other institutions at this moment is how we balance these two competing imperatives. On the one hand, the need to give Mr. Trump and his administration a fair hearing, mm-hmm. to not be caught up in all the hysteria, not to live tweet by tweet, to judge him on what he does, not on what he tweets. But on the other hand, our responsibility as analysts and observers to say what we think and to assess him honestly against his predecessors, both Republican and Democratic. And that's one I think we all struggle with. What has been your guidance to your colleagues at the New York Times about giving him a fair hearing, but at the same time not getting intimidated by the claims of the failing New York Times and fake news and so on, and letting him get off without the kind of fair, tough, rigorous analysis that any president deserves?
Yeah, I think we feel as though, I'm speaking for the New York Times newsroom, we're not an opinion operation. We have an opinion section of the New York Times, and that we have colleagues, including Brett Stevens, who you had here, and he comes from the opinion section, and he would articulate the dilemma for a columnist or an opinion writer about how to grapple with Trump probably a little bit differently. The news operation of the New York Times is fundamentally a nonpartisan operation, and we're not going to make a collective call on deciding at some point, for example, this president is just fundamentally illegitimate and we're just going to war with him. That's not the way we make our decisions. We will continue to cover him, though, very aggressively, to use all the power and expertise of the teams that we have covering the White House and the major departments of the U.S. government, to you know, with all of the, you know, comparisons with previous presidencies, with some sort of objective standards of his effectiveness, you know, to make, you know, important analytical calls about the success or failure of things that he's doing. But at the end of the day, there's a real journalistic opportunity that we have and that we think actually others probably are underinvested in, you know, to try to be a fundamentally nonpartisan news organization that tries to look for ways in which you can understand why, for example, Trump's base of support is so resilient. I mean, that's a good story for us. Like, what are people thinking? How are they reacting to these events? You know, how are things going on in their lives informing some of the political decisions that they make? The thing, you know, conventional wisdom about the benefits of free trade, for example, are things that, you know, most people in the mainstream media, you know, probably didn't examine very rigorously in the past. And I think something like the Trump presidency has caused us to ask some tough questions about trade and who benefits and to take a look at emotionally how those things play in American life. I don't think we would have done exactly that kind of reporting in another administration because it was not as live an issue. But Trump has caused us to ask some hard questions about maybe some underlying assumptions and to try to kind of really listen to people on another side of that debate and try to understand it better. So I actually think that, you know, the Trump presidency, for a nonpartisan news organization, the Trump presidency is a big journalistic opportunity. And instead of getting caught up in, are we going to say yes or no to this guy, or are we going to kind of call him right or wrong, which is some of what you do analytically, ultimately we have to look for the most well-rounded report to sort of basically increase people's understanding of what's happening. And we have to be a level above the debate. We are not a partisan in the debate, but we are an active journalistic participant in understanding the partisanship is the way that I would put it. And, you know, there isn't that much space for every news organization to do it, and some are going to pick sides, and many already have picked sides, but we think the more they pick sides, the more opportunity there is for us at that other level.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I said at the beginning that the New York Times is an indispensable newspaper, and I think actually the answer that Joe has just given to that question, a very thoughtful, impressive answer, tells us why it's indispensable. I'm sure that everyone at the Institute at least once per day clicks onto the New York Times and reads it, and it's because you put out such a fantastic product. We've been delighted to host your colleague, Brett Stevens. There are other opportunities for us to work together, and today, Joe, we were really honoured to have you and to have you answer our questions on everything from China to Washington. Good luck in your Andrew Olley lecture this evening. Thanks for visiting us. Thanks for taking a close look at Australia through Damien Cave in your bureau here. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Joe Carman.
Thanks, Jeff.